You don't understand me. The first 20 minutes is that I'm shifting gears from airplanes to Mark Twain. The last half of the period, I don't know what my excuse will be, but I think I'm confronted with a subject that's so full of possibilities that I'm in danger of mouthing off all period. And if I start doing that, please interrupt me at any place you want to ask questions or make a comment or counter something I've said. I picked Mark Twain, although he might seem like a strange subject at Holden Village, but he seems to me a classic case of what happens to any number of American writers who somehow fail to find some sort of center for their being, whether it's God or a social system or some kind of belief. And I think one of the difficulties with Mark Twain is that he never did find that. Well, I'll get into that kind of Mark Twain, but let me start by just kind of getting a sense of the crowd here and what your opinion of Mark. What do you like Mark Twain? Do you read him at all? Have you read him at all? Have you read Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn or not? Let me get some opinions. Go ahead.
Yeah, I really do enjoy. I think it's really like Mark Twain and Finn. I think are really entertaining to me. Like, it's just kind of giving me a sense of history too, in a way. Like nostalgia, the olden days when boys were free and you know to roam and everything. It's kind of tied in with that. It's entertaining.
Are you saying by that entertaining but not significant? Meaningful. You know, Sir Philip Sidney said the purpose of literature is to teach and delight, but it's very clear that the delight was simply to suck you into the teaching part of it. And I'm sure that most English teachers you've had have kind of adopted the same thing. It's sort of fun to play around with the character and the setting and everything, but ultimately you come to that big question in every English class, what does it mean? Right?
Mm-hmm. No, I don't see myself looking for any deep meaning in it or anything.
Fun. Twain is simply
Mark Twain or one of
Mark
his
Twain.
Books.
Any one of his books.
Oh. I think he's the greatest.
Okay, why?
Because he as a philosopher, lots of people who write literature, some of them, like Tolstoy and people who I call the great ones, don't just deal with life as they've observed it, but they pass on to the reader some deep observations of human nature, and they're philosophical about it in the best sense. And then there are even fewer of those who have the guts to challenge the superficial and the phony in society. Mark Twain did both. He was a satirist too, and he challenged directly the fakery of life. As an example.
Okay, you just introduced a phrase that's given me my whole lecture. I'm going to cram my notes.
Okay, I'll let you go.
See what you're missing by just reading him for entertainment. He's confronting the fakery of life. Well, let me push you further, because I'm rewriting my lecture now, and that'll give me a little more time. What do you mean, the fakery of life?
Well, as an example, he has Huckleberry Finn is disturbed by the fact when he's on the raft that he's helping the big Negro man to get away, because he's breaking the law. You know, he's betraying his own white race by helping a slave get away. But gradually, Mark Twain has us Huckleberry Finn being an open, straightforward, honest person himself about life, begins to realize, even as a boy, that here is this Negro, he no longer is a slave to me, he's a human being. And so through the mind of the mental processes of Huckleberry Finn, Mark Twain has us realize that society sets up rules like that just to benefit the people who do benefit by them. But here he's Huckleberry Finn, and the black are really the greater people than the people who make the laws. That they're people who really want to take another person for what he is, which is closer to the Christian approach, it seems to me, too. That's an example where I think he's...
Okay, let's start there, because it seems to me that you're essentially right, that Twain's humor, in all its guises, was a poking fun at one pretense or another, the phoniness or the fakery of life. But it seems to me, and let me just kind of briefly trace his career, it seems to me that Twain reaches a point, unknown, I suppose, to most people, and unknown to anybody before the last 20 years when the Twain papers were finally opened and a totally different image of Mark Twain emerged, that there reaches a point at which the exposure of phoniness somehow goes beyond the limits permitted a Christian. I'm not saying that well, but let me start at the beginning. Twain was a Western humorist, and Western humor always involved somehow pointing up the hypocrisies of the dude, the funny way he dresses, yeah, making fun of the naivete of civilizations who preach one thing and practice another thing. A good example, for instance, of that you all know from Mark Twain's Western period is the Jumping Frog of Calaveras County, in which Twain has a frog loaded with buckshot so that it can't win the race. A lesser known but even better example of this kind of poking fun at pretense, it came in his series of reports when he was a reporter for the Virginia City Enterprise, in which in the Virginia City Enterprise, as a reporter, reported the discovery by a group of anthropologists of what appeared to be the foot of a huge, gigantic, petrified man who had been mummified and turned into stone. And the Eastern papers caught this and took it up. And week after week, as he reported in the Virginia City Enterprise, they've gotten up to his knees, now they've uncovered the thighs, and it's just an incredibly great, gigantic man. What does it mean as far as anthropology is concerned? The East waited breathlessly for these announcements. And finally, but nobody in the East ever did, and the Eastern papers all covered it, if you put all of those things together, the position, the hand and the thumb is north by northwest by so and so many degrees, all full of scientific jargon and language, if you had bothered to put all those reports together, you would see that the petrified man was lying in this position. Just thumbing his nose. I mean, Twain was just pulling a big hoax, laughing at the pretenses of people getting sucked in by scientific jargon. Okay, then he gets to what you've already suggested is a far more serious look at the pretense of society in Huckleberry Finn. And I suppose Huckleberry Finn, I would agree with most critics, is sort of the high point of Twain's career as a great writer. In Huckleberry Finn, and let me just sort of repeat some of the things you said, the essential story is Huckleberry's decision to not only escape from society, but to help the black slave Jim escape down the river to freedom. They're going to go up the Ohio River. Huckleberry is not very sure at the beginning. He has adopted most of society's mores about the blacks, that is, that they are inferior, that slavery is a good institution, that it is justified by God, because Huckleberry has heard preachers preach on that theme. And so Huckleberry is worried about what will happen should he help Jim escape. And there's a real growth on Huckleberry Finn's part when he reaches the point that you mentioned, when literally believing that if he helps Jim, if he makes the decision to help Jim escape, he will go to hell, because his church has said anybody helping a slave escape will be, and thus violating the mores of society, will be condemned. Huckleberry Finn, at the moment he says, "All right, I'll help Jim and go to hell," it's important, I think, to believe, and that's a profound insight, that Huckleberry really believes he is going to go to hell for what he is doing. But he is willing to forego principle for practice. He is willing to put his service to mankind above his own personal worth. And that's a quite different and more grown-up Huckleberry than we saw in that Playful Tom Sawyer or in the beginning. But then a strange thing happens to Mark Twain. If you've read the rest of Huckleberry Finn, all of a sudden, it's as if Twain and I don't have any explanation better than most of the critics, almost as if Twain suddenly realized that he was in hot water, that he was in over his head, that he was on the verge of something too profound for him to handle, too profound for his audience. And Twain always had his eye on the market, and he backs off, and introduces Tom Sawyer again, and introduces all that fun and games at the end where they are down on Uncle Silas Phelps' farm, Jim has been recaptured, and they make all kinds of play of escaping, so that the last fifth of Huckleberry Finn is in many ways a regression back to that early corny humor of Mark Twain. What happened? Why wasn't Twain able to carry that book through to its conclusions? Why give us a Huckleberry who really learns what it means to be a human being and then back off? Not only that, but beginning with Huckleberry Finn and following, Twain, who had already pointed up the phoniness of the East and the phoniness of morals and the phoniness of society and the phoniness of religion, increasingly comes to have gloomier and gloomier images of both man and, more important, of God, of religion. Twain never really did find a religion he was comfortable with. He was raised as a very stern Calvinist Presbyterian. He tinkered with all sorts of offshoot religions throughout his life. For a time, he sort of ascribed to Christian Science, theosophy, and all the new philosophies being imported from Europe that I'll talk about in a minute. Eventually, after 1884, with the publication of Huckleberry Finn, we find an increasingly bitter and pessimistic and black comic writer in Mark Twain, until by the end of his career, with works like The Mysterious Stranger, with which I'd like to spend most of the time today, we have a Twain who is totally different, who sees no hope for man, who sees not one redeeming quality in anyone, let alone society at large, and who thinks the whole universe is an absurd joke. Let me just try to trace that despairing Twain, because most of the Twains you are familiar with are the Twains who are much more joshing. Many of the things I want to quote from are things that have only been published in the last 20 years, when Clara Twain finally died and her estate at the University of California was allowed to be opened. And suddenly we discover that Mark Twain was not such a humorous writer, that his life was not nearly as comfortable as we had all thought that it was. In the first place, in looking at the phoniness, Twain comes increasingly to see that everything that man does is phony. Let me just limit myself to the area of religion and use three examples, and then turn to The Mysterious Stranger, where he begins to ridicule the universe and the whole idea of any kind of God. Who could have let this great joke happen? I'm going to read, first of all, from one of his letters to Earth. He wrote a series of very bitter letters by Satan and by Satan's helpers, similar in many ways to the Screwtape letters, except that there is no message of redemption. There are no redeeming qualities to these letters at all. These are all letters which laugh at man's concept of God. I'm going to read particularly two letters that laugh at the concept of prayer and how stupid and silly prayer is. Here is a letter written by the Office of the Recording Angel, Department of Petitions. These are letters written down the earth, and letters written to various people who have prayed various things. And I think you'll see, as I read just a small sample of it, what Twain thinks of prayer, particularly the kind of prayers that most of us pray: for a raise, for a warmer weather, for colder weather, for this and for that, for rain, for no rain, and so forth. Things that we want done. The recording angel writes, "I have the honor, as per command, to inform you that your recent act of benevolence and self-sacrifice has been recorded upon a page of the book called Golden Deeds of Men, a distinction, I am permitted to remark, which is not merely extraordinary, it is unique. As regards your prayers for the week ending the 19th, I have the honor to report as follows. For whether to advance hard coal 15 cents a ton, granted. For influx of laborers to reduce wages 10%, granted. For a break in rival soft coal prices, granted. For a visitation upon the man or upon the family of the man who has set up a competing retail coal yard in Rochester, granted as follows. Diphtheria 2, 1 fatal. Scarlet fever, 1, to result in deafness and imbecility. Note, this prayer should have been directed against his subordinates' principals, the New York Central Railroad Company. For deportation to hell of annoying swarms of persons who apply daily for work or for favors of one sort or another, taken under advisement for later decision and compromise, this petition appearing to conflict with another of the same date, which will be cited further along. 6, for application of some form of violent death to the neighbor who threw a brick at the family cat, whilst the same was serenading, reserved for consideration and compromise because of conflict with a prayer of even date to be cited further along, and so forth. Prayer 7, to damn the missionary cause, reserved also as above. Prayer 8, to increase December profits of $22,230 to $45,000 for January, and perpetuate a proportionate monthly increase thereafter, which will satisfy you, the prayer granted. For a cyclone to destroy the works and fill up the mine of the North Pennsylvania Company, no, cyclones are not kept in stock in the winter season. A reliable article of fire damp can be furnished upon application. And then he goes through the remainder of prayers and divides prayers and so forth. The problem, of course, with prayers is that at the very moment a laborer is praying for an increase in wages, an employer somewhere else in the country is praying for a decrease in wages, and invariably all the prayers of men end up conflicting. And how is God going to decide which prayer to grant? He decides on the following basis, as far as Twain is concerned. I have the honor to call your attention to the fact that you seem to have deteriorated. To resume report upon your public prayers with your side remark that in order to encourage Christians of your grade and of approximate grades, it is the custom of this office to grant many things to them which would not be granted to Christians of a higher grade, partly because they would not be asked for. Prayer for weather mercifully tempered to the needs of the poor and the naked, denied. This was a prayer meeting prayer. It conflicts with item 1 of this report, which was a secret supplication of the heart. By a rigid rule of this office, certain sorts of public prayers of a professional Christian are forbidden to take precedence of secret supplications to the heart, and so forth and so on. One other prayer that has become, as a result of the Vietnam War, a particularly well-known piece of Twain writing, is the so-called war prayer, and I'd like to read from that, because it takes this whole idea that, I mean, Twain, in other words, was during this whole period, really losing his faith in the fact that anything was not phony, that there was anything genuine to anything that man did. And at some point after Huckleberry Finn, he just loses faith in man entirely. The war prayer, I assume this has to do with the Spanish-American War, which was another singularly idiotic war in our history, deals with a prayer of the church for victory in battle. Paul Hain, in his Old Testament Lessons for the Week, has been playing off the same idea. Why should we pray for dominion over others? But here's the war prayer. Sunday morning came. Next day the battalions would leave for the front. The church was filled. The volunteers were there, their young faces alight with martial dreams. Visions of the stern advance, the gathering momentum, the rushing charge, the flashing saber, and so forth. With the volunteers sat their dear ones, proud, happy, envied by the neighbors and friends who had no sons and brothers to send forth to the field of honor, there to win for the flag, or, failing, die the noblest of noble deaths. The service proceeded. A war chapter from the Old Testament was read. The first prayer was said. It was followed by an organ burst that shook the building. And with one impulse, the house rose with glowing eyes and beating hearts and poured out that tremendous invocation, God the All-Terrible, Thou who ordainest thunder thy clarion and lightning thy sword. Then came the long prayer. None could remember the like of it for passionate pleading and moving and beautiful language. The burden of its supplication was that an ever-merciful and benign Father of us all would watch over our noble young soldiers and aid and comfort and encourage them in their patriotic work. And suddenly into this church service comes an aged stranger. Notice the way in which, in Twain, increasingly strangers come into a community and stir up trouble, as they do in The Mysterious Stranger, The Man, The Corrupted Hadleyburg, and so forth. Most strangers, the whole idea of a stranger coming into a community, I could stop and say here, is ordinarily more of the Lone Ranger type. The stranger who comes in, no one knows his name, no one knows from where he came, he is mysterious, but somehow he sets things right. He solves the problems of the town and rides away victorious. He comes in other words, to help. He comes in as a savior. But twain strangers come in, and always there is trouble and dissension that follow because of human nature, which simply cannot tolerate the truth that the stranger brings with him. This stranger comes in, and everybody stops right in the middle of his prayer for victory in war, and says, he's a very mysterious kind of stranger. During some moments, he surveyed the spellbound audience with solemn eyes in which burned an uncanny light. Then, in a deep voice, he said, "I come from the throne, bearing a message from Almighty God." The words smote the house with a shock, if the stranger perceived that he gave no attention. "He has heard the prayer of his servant, your shepherd, and will grant it if such be your desire, after I, his messenger, shall have explained to you its import." That is to say, its full import. "For it is like unto many of the prayers of men, in that it asks for more than he who utters it is aware of, except he pause and think. God's servant and yours has prayed his prayer." He has paused and taken thought. Is it one prayer? No, it is two, one uttered and the other not. Both have reached the ears of him who heareth all supplications, the spoken and the unspoken. You have heard your servant's prayer, the utter part of it. I am commissioned of God to put into words the other part of it, that part which the pastor and also you in your hearts fervently prayed silently. God grant that it was so. You heard these words, "Grant us the victory, O Lord our God." That is sufficient. The whole of the uttered prayer is compact in those pregnant words. When you have prayed for victory, you have prayed for many unmentioned results which follow victory, must follow it. Upon the listening spirit of God the Father fell also the unspoken part of the prayer. He commanded me to put it into words. Listen. O Lord our Father, our young patriots, idols of our hearts, go forth to battle. Be thou near them. With them in spirit, we also go forth from the sweet peace of our beloved firesides to smite the foe. O Lord our God, help us to tear their soldiers to bloody shreds with our shells. Help us to cover their smiling fields with the pale forms of their patriot dead. Help us to drown the thunder of the guns with the shrieks of their wounded, writhing in pain. Help us to lay waste their humble homes with a hurricane of fire. Help us to wring the hearts of their unoffending widows with unavailing grief. Help us to turn them out roofless with their little children to wander unfriended the wastes of the desolate land in rags and hunger and thirst. Imploring thee for the refuge of the grave and denied it. For our sake who adore thee, Lord, blast their hopes, blight their lives, protect their bitter pilgrimage. Make heavy their steps, waste their way with tears, stain the white snow with the blood of their wounded feet. We ask it in the spirit of love, of him who is the source of love, and who is the ever-faithful refuge and friend of all that are sore beset, and seek his aid with humble and contrite hearts. Amen. And Twain's last comment, it was believed afterwards by the congregation that the man was a lunatic because there was no sense in what he said. Well, here is a Twain quite different from the Twain that you outline in Huckleberry Finn. A Twain for whom everything, even religious things, are becoming simply hypocritical lunacies on the part of man. If man only realized these stupidities, I think Twain has the feeling somehow he might laugh his way out of them, but increasingly, Twain came to feel that men did not do that. And then one final thing before I turn the mysterious stranger.
Role.
Yeah.
Because a man suddenly in his life or during a part of his life becomes a Jeremiah, does that make him an unchristian?
No.
Okay.
Jeremiah is an interesting concept to it.
Yeah, this is Mark Twain as a Jeremiah. Maybe this is
it. Okay, when you call him a Jeremiah, I can see right now I probably will not get to the mysterious stranger today. Can you let's look at Twain for a minute as a Jeremiah. Let me read one other thing and then come back
sure.
to it because it's in this
he told us interrupted.
Thank you, Paul. This is a beautiful attack on missionaries that Twain did also as a part of this despairing period of his, called To the Person Sitting in Darkness. He has picked up a column from having to do with the Boer War, the Boxer Rebellion in China, in which the Chinese rebelled against the dominion of particularly Americans, but of the English and French and Germans too, the people who were in China ripping it off. And as a result of the Boxer Rebellion, many Christian churches and communities were burned down and people killed. And each of the countries, America, France, and Germany, and England, demanded of the Chinese, after the Boxer Rebellion was put down, demanded reparations in terms of money and in terms of life for life. I mean, it's not a very good picture of our missionary endeavor, and Twain happened to pick that up. Here is the article that appears and Twain simply quotes it and then makes a comment on it. The following news, Twain writes, the following news from China appeared in the Sun of New York on Christmas Eve. The Reverend Mr. Ahmed of the American Board of Foreign Missions has returned from a trip which he made for the purpose of collecting indemnities for damages done by Boxers. Everywhere he went, he compelled the Chinese to pay. He says that all his native Christians are now provided for. He had 700 of them under his charge, and 300 were killed. He has collected 300 taels for each of these murders, and has compelled full payment for all of the property belonging to Christians that was destroyed. He also assessed fines amounting to 13 times the amount of the indemnity. This money will be used for the propagation of the gospel. Mr. Ament declared that the compensation he has collected is moderate when compared with the amount secured by the Catholics, who demand, in addition to money, head for head. They collect 500 taels for each murder of a Catholic. In the Wenchiu country, 680 Catholics were killed, and for this, the European Catholics here demanded 750,000 strings of cash and 680 heads. Mr. Ahmed goes on to deny that the missionaries are vindictive at all. But on the other hand, he says, the Americans are too soft. The soft hand of the Americans is not as good as the mailed fist of the Germans. If you deal with the Chinese with a soft hand, they will take advantage of it. Twain goes on to comment, by happy luck, we get all these glad tidings on Christmas Eve just in time to enable us to celebrate the day with proper gaiety and enthusiasm. Our spirits soar, and we find we can even make jokes. Tails I win, heads you lose, and so forth and so on. Do you have any comments, Paul? What do you mean by Twain as a Jeremiah?
Well, it was applied to what it applied particularly to the one you read just before, that this is also a piece of biting irony, which has a certain element of Jeremiah in it. He's crying out against the falsity of the pious Pharisaic society, especially the one that were previously.
Yeah, I mean, okay, anybody else? Any other comments at this point? Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about a person may not have been totally, I don't know, totally a Schopenhauer, where he would just became a complete black pessimist, say. But as a writer, he may have taken this direct satirical method of just opening the wounds of the, or opening up the rottenness of society by just scorning it and showing the deep contrasts, you know, as over against his more subtle method of the gradual way that you see that Huckleberry Finn begins to think in the way that Mark Twain thinks that people ought to think. So it isn't necessarily a sign that he's completely a sour apple guy or he's given up totally on society, although it appears that way. I have to say what I'm trying to say in a connection with my father-in-law and mother-in-law. We recommended to them several years ago that they go and see To Kill a Mockingbird. You remember that story with Gregory Peck in the movie? And in there, of course, here's this lawyer who tries to get justice for the black and is frustrated in the process. But I remember talking to my mother-in-law that she just thought it was an awful movie. She didn't get any point to it at all. You know, so I'm just raising the question whether Mark Twain, as the earlier writer, although he fell into the crankiness of old age too, and he was bitter about society and how it had beat him out in terms of what he was paid for his early writings and that sort of thing. You know, so I'm just raising the question whether Mark Twain, as the earlier writer, although he fell into the crankiness of old age too, and he was bitter about society and how it had beat him out in terms of what he was paid for his early writings and that sort of thing, but he may have given up in trying to use the subtle means of reaching the reader and just tried to just tell it the way it is, the way he felt it, and expose it, you know, and let the reader be pained by it. But the guys who are going to be real hypocritical anyway, they're going to ignore the statements he makes. But that some people, if he feels that they are discerning enough, they're going to get the point that he's making.
Yeah, I think he's certainly given up the kind of entertainment that you wanted him here, and is simply lashing out much more directly and much more vitriolically than he was in Huckleberry Finn.
Which they call it the prophetic spirit,
which is more subtle, Margaret.
I think you have to take a look at the guy as a total man, too. How old was he when he was in Virginia City? Remember?
He was young. He was in his 20s.
Early 30s. He was capable of writing at the Jumping Frog of Calaveras. But yet he did a little traveling in the Sierras in that time. He got as far as Bridgeport to Mono Lake, and he didn't give a lousy description of this fantastic country as a young man.
Yeah.
He didn't see it. Like maybe hundreds of people come to Holden Hill, oh, they see the mountains, but they don't hear a bird, they don't see a flower, anything else. But then he, as he grew older, I think the death of his daughter had a lot to do with that.
He
became a misanthrope. He was a hater of mankind. Deep, passionately hateful. But his books, we've all enjoyed them. I'd just like to give that interlude of Tom Sawyer going to church with Aunt Becky and the minister's prayer. Boy, I've read
that many times,
which has influenced my prayer life. Boy, I cut her short and sweet and make her direct and no gimme stuff.
There are all sorts of questions about why this bitterness tends to happen to humorists, as it does. Jonathan Swift, too, spent the last 3 years of his life in an insane asylum because somehow it must be incredibly difficult for a humorist not to go off the deep end, and where you're doing very clever and fun satire and spoofing to suddenly start taking it seriously. And that, I think, is what happened with Twain. How many of you have read The Mysterious, Margaret?
These things that didn't come up until after his daughter's death, did he intend them for publication?
No.
He did not?
No, he didn't, because nor did his estate, because they had created a character called Mark Twain. I mean, we're not really talking about a human being when we talk about Mark Twain. And that, I think, let me digress, as is my wont. One of the problems is that we're talking about a created character. In fact, I suppose you could say that Sam Clemens' greatest
greatest creation is Mark Twain. In the same way that Marilyn Monroe created a Marilyn Monroe for the market. And another reason for the pessimism, Ernie, the growing pessimism might be that, and you see it in the mass media everywhere today, that what America loved was essentially somebody who didn't exist, a character named Mark Twain who was a funny man, and way back there was poor real Sam Clemens trying to compete. Think of what it must be like to have been the real Marilyn Monroe, and have to live with the knowledge that the celluloid idol, totally fake and totally artificial, which you created, is the one that everybody loves, and they could care less about the real you. Think of what it must be like to be the real Johnny Carson, and have to live up, not only live up to, which you never can do, but to compete with that fake image which you created for the media. And essentially, I think that was Twain's problem. Nobody loved Sam Clemens. Everybody adored Mark Twain. Beneath Sam Clemens, another way of looking at this increasing pessimism is to see that there always was a Sam Clemens, very sensitive, very alive to social problems, very aware of human feelings. But you see, you can't, in the same way that today television can't handle anything very heavy, similarly Mark Twain can't handle anything very heavy too. He's the funny man. Bob Hope cannot come out, Jack Benny cannot come out and be Lenny Bruce. Nobody would understand. Everybody would laugh it off the stage. And so I think there's some real turmoil in Sam Clemens and real bitterness about the fact that everybody is taken in. I mean, the final fakery of the whole thing is that everybody's taken in by a created character. And the real human being, Sam Clemens, is lost in the shuffle. That must be a terrible thing to do. So don't we all do that? I mean, don't we all, as T.S. Eliot says, prepare a face to meet the faces that we meet, but never to the extent. Usually we call that face by the same name, you know, the old tweet. Remember the first date you were on, you know, what face you prepared to meet that other face, and then whether you worried when you got back home, you know, will he like the real me when he discovers what I'm really like? So it's nothing we don't all do, but I think the mass media has a way of exaggerating that to the point where Marilyn Monroe could not handle it. And I don't think Mark Twain could handle it either. Okay, The Mysterious Stranger. I'll just go through this briefly, and then if anybody's interested, I can come back to Twain on Thursday rather than going on to Hawthorne. The Mysterious Stranger was not published until 1916. It was published as a children's book with illustrations by N.C. Wyeth, the father of Andrew Wyeth. How it ever got by as a children's book, I will never know, because it seems to me to be Twain's final will and testament, and the one thing that really goes beyond the Jeremiah of the war prayer into true black comedy. It starts out in a very typical Twain way, two little boys in a sleepy little village in Austria named Aseldorf, which if you bother to translate it is Assville. These boys play much like Tom Sawyer, Huckleberry Finn played, and into their lives one day comes a stranger, that same stranger that always in Twain causes trouble. He plays with them. He's a stranger, and they make friends in the same way that Tom Sawyer made friends with the new boy there. But suddenly they discover that this boy can do magical things. He can make oranges appear. He can make matches light themselves without striking on anything. Soon there came toward us a youth strolling through the trees and sat down and began to talk in a friendly way, just as if he knew us. But we did not answer, for he was a stranger and we were not used to strangers. Even the language is reminiscent of the kind of idyllic nostalgia that you find in Tom Sawyer. But he starts making fire. He starts bringing oranges and apples through. And he goes on from making oranges and apples to making people. And all of a sudden, it becomes not such a pleasant thing anymore. You've been sucked in. In other words, Twain is taking you as dudes in, and then suddenly he lets the axe fall. He says, I'm 16,000 years old, counting as you count. He's already told him that his name is Satan. And that's frightened him a little bit, and that his uncle is Prince someplace. But also he's told them that he's an angel. And so they're not quite sure. But they do love the little tricks he plays until this trick. He creates two little workmen who are building a wall. He creates a whole little town of people only an inch tall. And they're playing all around, and the kids are just watching them in rapt delight because none of their toys have moved before. But here are real people quarreling and arguing and fighting with each other. Let me just read this passage. Two of the little workmen were quarreling, and in buzzing little bumblebee voices they were cursing and swearing at each other, and now playing blows and blood. Then they locked themselves together in a life and death struggle. Satan reached out his hand and crushed the life out of them with his fingers, threw them away, wiped the red from his fingers on his handkerchief, and went on talking where he had left off. We cannot do wrong, he is talking about his kind. Neither have we any disposition to do it, for we do not know what it is. It seemed a strange speech in the circumstances, but we barely noticed that. We were so shocked and grieved at the wanton murder he had committed. For murder it was, that was its true name, and it was without palliation or excuse, for the man had not wronged him in any way. It made us miserable, for we loved him and had thought him so noble and so beautiful and gracious, and had honestly believed that he was an angel. And to have him do this cruel thing, it lowered him so, and we had just had such pride in him. He went right on talking just as if nothing had happened, telling about his travels and so forth. And then suddenly, the widows of these two little men that he's killed discovered the deaths. The wives of the little dead men had found the crushed and shapeless bodies and were crying over them and sobbing and lamenting. And a priest was kneeling there with his hands crossed upon his breast, praying. And crowds of pitying friends were massed about them, reverently uncovered with their bare heads bowed, and many with tears running down, a scene which Satan paid no attention to until the small noise of the weeping and praying began to annoy him. Then he reached out and took the heavy board seat out of our swing and brought it down and mashed all those people into the earth just as if they had been flies, and went on talking just the same. An angel and kill a priest? An angel who did not know how to do wrong and yet destroys in cold blood hundreds of helpless poor men and women who had never done him any harm? It made us sick to see that awful deed and to think that none of those poor creatures was prepared except the priest, for none of them had ever heard a mass or seen a church. And we were witnesses. We had seen these murders done, and it was our duty to tell and let the law take its course. But he went right on talking, worked his enchantments upon us, made us forget everything. We could only listen to him and love him and be his slaves. You have there, I think, in microcosm, Twain's view, finally, of the whole joke that he sees God being. How could a God, and that's the question that I think Twain was finally unable to answer, how could a God who has any kind of justice, who has any kind of goodness in him, make man the way Twain had come to feel men were in this kind of black, dark period of his? He goes on, because the kids completely forget, the kids get used to this idea of murder. Here you have, I suppose in microcosm, the world, God creating man, toying with him, playing with him, and when he's through with them, crushing them out through no fault of their own. They haven't sinned, they haven't done anything wrong except to annoy some mightier being who could care less about them as individuals or as a society. He then goes on to create a little castle with knights and so forth. And when he gets tired of that, he brings a storm and disposes of them through natural calamity. All of this, of course, is an analogy to the way Twain is beginning, finally, at the end, in despair, to see life itself. The clouds settled down blacker and blacker, and one could see the castle only dimly through it. The lightning blazed out flash upon flash and pierced the castle and set it on fire. And the flames shone out red and fierce through the clouds, and the people came flying out shrieking. But Satan brushed them back, paying no attention to our begging and crying and imploring. And in the midst of the howling of the wind and the volleying of the thunder, the magazine blew up. The earthquake rent the ground wide, and the castle's wreck and ruin tumbled into the chasm, which swallowed it from sight and closed upon it
with all that innocent life, not one of the 500 poor creatures escaping. Our hearts were broken, we could not keep from crying. Don't cry, Satan said. They were of no value. But they are gone to hell. It's no matter, we can make plenty more. It was no use trying to move him. Evidently he was wholly without feeling and could not understand. He was full of bubbling spirits. Twain goes on, as Satan talks about the way in which God has his relationship with man, to compare it to an elephant versus an ant. Twain has Satan say, isn't it ridiculous to imagine that an elephant could ever feel anything for an ant, let alone need notice him in the first place? Well, far higher or far greater is the difference between whatever gods may be and man than ever could exist even between an elephant and an ant. Isn't it ridiculous to think that there ever could be such a thing as a personal God who could take any kind of concern for man himself? In the place of God, then, in this final black statement of Twain's, he puts a popular philosophy that was just coming in the 1890s, determinism. The idea that everything is simply cause and effect, and that's all there is to it. Let me simply go into that briefly. he says, on page 320, the children ask him to do various things, and he tells them that unless he changes one little incident in a life, a girl named Lisa is going to drown in 12 days, and they beg him to make a change, and so he makes a change. He says, I have saved her life. He says, and Nicholas is the person who's going to rescue Lisa. He says, I have made Nicholas go 3 seconds too late to open a window, and because of that, his whole future is changed. Remember the popular song a couple of years ago about the man who, on his way home from work, always turns left at Elm Street, but what would happen if I would turn right? My whole life would change, and I went right instead of left. From that single act, my whole life, my whole career would be different. And Twain is picking up that pop version of determinism. Straight off, he says, I was building that great future of Nicky's in my imagination. This is the little boy narrator talking. And had already made a renowned general of him and Hofmeister at the court, when I noticed that Satan was waiting for me to get ready to listen again. Nicky's appointed life is 62 years. That's grand, I said. Lisa's is 36. But as I told you, I shall change their lives and those ages. 2 minutes and a quarter from now, Nicholas will wake out of his sleep and find the rain blowing in. It was appointed that he should turn over and go to sleep again, but I have appointed that he shall get up and close the window first. That trifle will change his career entirely. He will rise in the morning 2 minutes later than the chain his life had appointed him to rise. By consequence, thenceforth, nothing will ever happen to him in accordance with the details of the old chain. He took out his watch and sat looking at it a few moments, then said, Nicholas has risen to close the window. His life is changed. His new career has begun. There will be consequences. It made me feel creepy. But for this change, certain things would happen 12 days from now. For instance, Nicholas would save Lisa from drowning. He would arrive on the scene at exactly the right moment, 4 minutes past 10, the long goal-pointed instant of time, and the water would be shallow, the achievement easy and certain. But he will arrive some seconds too late now. Lisa will have struggled into deeper water. He will do his best, but both will drown. Oh, Satan, dear Satan, I cried with the tears rising in my eyes. Save them. Don't let it happen. I can't bear to lose Nicholas. He is my loving playmate and friend. And think of poor Lisa's mother. I clung to him and begged and pleaded, but he was not moved. He made me sit down again and told me I must hear him out. I have changed Nicholas's life, and this has changed Lisa's. If I had not done this, Nicholas would save Lisa. Then he would catch cold from his drenching. One of your race's fantastic and desolate scarlet fevers would follow with pathetic after effects. For 46 years he would lie in his bed, a paralytic log, deaf, dumb, and blind, and praying night and day for the blessed relief of death. Shall I change his life back? No, no, not for the world. In charity and pity, leave it as it is. It is best so. I could not have changed any other link in his life and done him so good a service. He had a billion possible careers, but not one of them was worth living. They were charged full with miseries and disasters. But for my intervention, he would do his brave deed 12 days from now, a deed begun and ended in 6 minutes, and get for all reward those 46 years of sorrow and suffering I told you of. It is one of the cases I was thinking of a while ago when I said that sometimes an act which brings the actor an hour's happiness is paid for by years of suffering. I wondered what poor little Lisa's early death would save her from. He answered my thought. From 10 years of pain and slow recovery from an accident, and then from 19 years pollution, shame, depravity, crime, ending with death at the hands of the executioner. 12 days hence, she will die now. Her mother would save her life if she could. Am I not kinder than her mother? As it turns out, the lives of all the people in the villages are destined because of the fates of the universe, because of the joke which the universe has played on man, are all destined to end unhappily. And any instant death is better than almost any future for any of these people. Having presented them this extremely black view of man, a universe essentially without any god except some kind of joke up there, Twain reserves his own final joke for the end, and let me go to that now. Satan announces on one of his last visits to the boys that he is not going to come back again, and they get into this conversation, and listen to it carefully. Are you going away, the boy says, and will not come back anymore? Yes, he said, we have comraded long together and it has been pleasant. Pleasant for both, but I must go now, and we won't see each other anymore. In this life, Satan, but in another, we shall meet in another, surely. Then, all tranquility and soberly, he made the strange answer, there is no other. A subtle influence blew upon my spirit from his, bringing with it a vague, dim, but blessed hope, feeling the incredible words might be true, must be true. Have you never suspected this, Theodore? How could I? But if it can only be true, it is true. A gust of thankfulness rose in my breast, but a doubt checked it before it could issue in words. And I said, but we have seen that future life, seen it in actuality. It was a vision. It had no existence. I could hardly breathe. A vision? Life itself is only a vision, a dream. It was electrical. I had had the very thought 1,000 times in my musing. Nothing exists. All is a dream. God, man, the world, the sun, the moon, the wilderness of stars, all a dream. They have no existence. Nothing exists save empty space and you. If you detect another popular 19th century philosophy, idealism, coming in, Twain is now plugging into that. And you are not you. You have no body, no blood, no bones. You are but a thought. I myself have no existence. I am but a dream, creature of your imagination. I am perishing, Satan says. I am failing. I am passing away. In a little while you will be alone in shoreless space to wander its limitless solitudes without friend or comrade forever, for you will remain a thought, the only existent thought. Strange that you should not have suspected it years ago, centuries, eons ago, for you have existed companionless through all eternity. Strange indeed that you should not have suspected that your universe was only a dream, visions, fiction. Strange because they are so frankly and hysterically insane, like all dreams. A God who could make good children as easily as bad, yet preferred to make bad ones. who could have made every one of them happy, yet never made a single happy one, who made them prize their bitter life, yet stingily cut it short, who gave his angels eternal happiness unearned, yet required his other children to earn it, who gave his angels painless lives, yet cursed his children with biting miseries and maladies of mind and body, who mouths justice and invented hell, mouths mercy and invented hell, mouths golden rules and forgiveness multiplied by 70 times 7 and invented hell, who frowns upon crimes yet commits them all, who created man without invitation, then tries to shuffle the responsibility for man's acts upon man instead of honorably placing him where it belongs, upon himself, and finally, with altogether divine obtuseness, invites this poor, abused slave to worship him. You perceive now that these things are all impossible except in a dream. You perceive that they are pure, puerile insanities, the silly creations of an imagination that is not conscious of its freaks. They are a dream, and you are the maker of it. It is true that which I have revealed unto you. There is no God, no universe, no human race, no earthly life, no heaven, no hell. It is all a grotesque and foolish dream. He vanished and left me appalled, for I knew and realized that all that he had said was true. It seems to me then that between the point at which Paul, you were calling Twain a Jeremiah in the war prayer,
more like a Nietzsche,
and this, we now have gone beyond the bounds.
Oh, yes.
And I think the reason is, let me come back to what I said at the beginning, that Twain never was able to find any kind of center around which to hang some sort of belief. Partly because Mark Twain was a celluloid creation, a figure, a mass media creation, and not the real Sam Clemens underneath.
I felt that he had it, and he became bitter and lost it. Possibly people would definitely die or something that reverses it. My sense of...
Okay, but...
Being present in the one I call Jeremiah.
Jeremiah is good. I like
this
that.
This is a man, a tormented man. This is a Job who has minded his friends and who is sitting and cursing God and dying. That's what he's doing.
That's what he's doing, but he's doing it totally outside the context in which even Job is doing it, it seems to me.
No, but Job didn't do it. Job said, "I know that my Redeemer liveth."
Okay, Job was asked to do it, and
he didn't do it, but
and had the basis for doing it, but Twain did it.
Yes.
Sarah?
Well, in reading that, Satan spends a lot of time telling how terrible the human race is, and how, creating wars and animals don't act like you, and sounds all like Ivan Karamazov many times through the thing. But then then you have these deterministic factors, and then the part at the end where it's all an illusion, all an act. And I don't know, there seems a bit of a contradiction.
Okay, I think Sarah, what Twain is doing here is shifting the blame. It's clear that in the war prayer to the person sitting in darkness and so forth, he is pointing up man's lunacies. But here, finally, the whole universe, Twain's whole vision of it has gotten so ludicrous that he's shifting the blame to God. I really see that in The Mysterious Stranger, man gets off the hook. We're not responsible. You know, I'm not responsible for my daughter's death, for my bankruptcy, for the fact that my career is downhill. Something else is to blame. The whole joke that is the universe.
But do you think he was wrestling through it because here is Satan determining or is a deterministic force in all these lives, which no one can do anything, but yet all the time through it he is talking about all the lunacies that man has done. I mean, there still seems to be that tension. And like you say, it's sort of resolved at the end when Twain finally decides, well, it's all God's fault or someone's fault.
Well, it's true that man's lunacies and God's idiocies fit neatly together in this picture. That probably if there were no universe, if there were no God foreordaining all of these things. In fact, there's a point, a passage that I forgot to read in which they ask Satan, is this foreordained? And Twain says,
No. It's all just accident. And that reminds me of Hardy's, you know, Thomas Hardy was shared some of the same kind of black universe that Twain shared at about the same time, and for some of the same reasons. And Hardy has a poem too in which he complains. He said, if I could know that my suffering and pain and that man's suffering were at least giving somebody a good time, a God who enjoyed that kind of thing, then maybe I could bear it. But it's to no purpose at all. Nobody is getting a kick out of this. Not even any malicious God. And therefore, the whole thing becomes ludicrous and stupid and idiotic. No, it's a quite different Mark Twain that's emerged since those papers and since these stories have come up. We're way beyond the kind of balanced mind in Huckleberry Finn. But Twain never found what it was at the center of things. And this happened to Jonathan Swift, it happened to Mark Twain, I think it happened to Lenny Bruce. Too.
The only thing that disturbs me, though, is that we don't take him, whether it was Mark Twain or Samuel Clemens. Samuel Clemens was writing and had a message as a Mark Twain. I mean, he wasn't trying to put up a mask to deceive people. He still wanted his message to get across. And we can still read him and think about what he said. Because I'm concerned that it can happen. I remember in school when they talked about Luther, they talked about the Der Alte Luther. That is, well, he, after all, he says so-and-so when he was, what was he, grow to be 60-some years of age or so. But this was the old Luther, you know. He was, after all, he had kind of gone a little nuts about them. And it makes it very convenient for society then to say, well, let's discredit almost everything he said then when he challenged the whole, beautifully challenged the whole institution of slavery and prejudice in the South, when if the nation back then had listened to him a little bit, maybe we wouldn't have had the civil rights things come so late in life. You know?
Don't you think the difference between Jeremiah, though, and Mark Twain is that Jeremiah can brood and have dark visions, but somehow at the bottom he said yes to something.